At any rate, I want to go ahead and introduce Dr. Aaron Feldman. Dr. Feldman received his master's degree in counseling from Johns Hopkins University and his doctorate in counseling psychology from Georgia State University. Please help me welcome Dr. Feldman.
Okay, thank you very much. It's actually a pleasure to be here. Before I actually get started with the words that pertain to the topic, I'd like to just work through some conflict, a beef that I had. For those of you who saw the flyer that went around about this event, it seemed like there was a list of people all with honorary titles describing their positions. And when it came to my name, it said Aaron Feldman, psychologist, funny man. I had nothing to do with that. Nothing whatsoever. Actually, I found out about it after the brochure, after the flyer had already been put out, and got it in an email and then saw Rabbi Pollack shortly thereafter. And of course, went directly up and said, Rabbi Pollack, what were you thinking? I mean, what is that? Funny man. What are people going to think? I mean, this could be some nice exposure for me. Now you're going to say funny man? How could you do that? And I was going ballistic. And those of you who know Rabbi Pollack know he just stood there with his hands behind his back, smiling, shaking side to side. I know. After I finished that rant, and it could have gone on for a long time, he said, by the way, Aaron, what do you think you'd like to speak about? And I said, oh, I'd probably be really appropriate if I talked about dealing with conflict in relationship in a healthy, mature manner. And I'm not sure what happened next, but if I recall correctly, he turned around and muttered under his breath and said, you have no idea what I meant when I said funny man. Okay. I think that by now, through other speakers, we've gotten the message that we're here to encourage different aspects, the idea, the concept of building healthy relationships. So one aspect of a healthy relationship is being in a relationship where we are both committed to meeting the needs of our spouse and where we feel that our spouse is committed to meeting our needs. And so tonight I want to just highlight a few ideas, practical as well, and I think a lot of them actually have been said, but repeating them over and over again is always helpful. But I'd like to just highlight a few aspects that both actually prevent us from achieving that goal of being in a marriage where we feel our needs are being met and providing for the needs of our spouse, and some of those things that will allow us to achieve it more effectively. So what I'd like to do, you know, since I'm not an educator, I'd like to start with the negative, right? But so one of the things that I think I see commonly, I'd like to just talk about one of the things that interferes with a couple's ability in a relationship to create that atmosphere where each one feels that their needs are being met and that their spouse is committed. And Roz actually mentioned, I think, and she said two aspects that very much relate to this concept. And I want to elaborate on that, and then we'll talk about how. A positive way we can meet each other's needs. But one of the things that I constantly see, and I definitely am guilty of, that interferes with our ability to do that, is how we ask for our needs to be met. One of the things that I think is amazing about human behavior is that for some reason, so many of us, have this notion that if I can clearly articulate to my spouse in excruciatingly painful detail exactly what they're doing incorrectly and provide years of evidence for this being a predominant theme, they will then respond and say, you know, you're right. And it happens over and over and over again. I almost feel like when I get a couple in my office and they finish expressing their complaints, I probably have actually said this, does the prosecution rest? And yet we're convinced that if we do that, that if we clearly prove and demonstrate that they're wrong and that they've done this and that they should be doing it this way, and don't they realize and can't they see, and I'm only trying to help, that they're going to be so happy and immediately adjust course and respond. Right. And by the way, you know, to top it all off, usually it ends something like this, and you know what, and you do this and this, and it doesn't just happen here, it happens that way too. And sometimes, and you know why you do that? It's because of your mother. Your mother, she's like that. Oh, thank you. Now that you've shown me where I got it from, I think I can do something about it. You've got to be kidding. We believe that that will work. So how we ask is important. And why do we ask that way? Why do we feel compelled to do that? We feel compelled to do that. Maybe we're afraid of rejection. We're afraid our spouse won't want to meet our needs. Maybe we don't want to feel needy. It's hard to ask for our needs to be met. Maybe we feel we have to justify them. And very often, when you think you're justifying your request, you're really prosecuting. Let me give an illustration, a simple statement of, I'm going to say the same thing two different ways, but I'm going to be saying the same thing. A husband can say to his wife, Lisa, you're so cold. You never touch me anymore. What's wrong with you? On a side note, the question, what's wrong with you, is not actually a question. That's a statement. Usually when you ask your spouse or a child, what's wrong with you, that actually means you think something is significantly wrong, you just haven't come up with the complicated term to capture it. However, so think about that. Lisa, you're so cold. You never touch him anymore. What's wrong with you? Now listen to this. Lisa, I really miss your touch. It feels like it's been a long time. I love it when you touch me. I'm not going to ask for a raise of hands. How many think that would actually work more effectively? Right. Are we saying anything different? No. Instead of prosecuting, we're actually, Roz used the idea of an I message, but we're expressing what we need, why we need it, and the payoff that it provides. And we give our spouse an opportunity to succeed. And I think I want us to focus on that. And if you can almost, if your spouse is sitting next to you, or if you can remember when you go home, one of the things that will create an atmosphere that will allow you to possibly shift away from providing those prosecutions is if you tell your spouse every once in a while, I want you to know I really am committed to meeting your needs. I'd like to know how, or I really do, I want to meet your needs. I know I stink at it. You've told me over and over again. You might want to leave that part out. I get carried away. Right, just, you know, you talk about when you attribute it to your mother. Imagine being married to a psychologist. Yeah, I had a colleague who told me that comes up and it's a problem. That colleague, maybe that me, I don't know, whose wife told him, okay, by the way, and no, I don't want to know why I do that. And actually, let's assume from this point on, I never want to know why I do that. I'm perfectly happy remaining ignorant. I don't need your help. I think he got the message after that. So he told me why she does it. Okay, so that's the one aspect, the aspect of staying away, of what prevents us from getting our needs met, how we ask, prosecuting. When we prosecute, our spouse feels like what we're doing is try to prove what they're doing wrong. And what they don't realize is that's not our intent. We just want them to know how they can make us happy, what we need, what we would really appreciate it. So tell them that you want to do that, and tell it to each other. That might help with that. Now, Roz mentioned a book. Somebody asked her, what's the name of the book? The book is called The Five Love Languages. The Five Love Languages, and because of time, I'm going to go through it very quickly. I'm going to just provide the basic concepts of it, and then I'm going to tell you a story from my own relationship, which I'll allow my wife to leave the room before I do that, that illustrates how that sometimes plays a role in our marriage. But the basic concept of the five love languages is that another reason it's difficult for us sometimes to create a relationship where we feel our needs are being met and that we are successfully meeting the needs of our spouses is because love very often for many people is expressed in different languages. And so our spouse may be trying, we may be trying, and we may get frustrated because we think, I keep doing this for them. I tell them this, I tell them they look beautiful, I'm always complimenting, and then I don't get the things I want in response. And so you're making an effort, but you're not getting it back, or you think you're not getting it back, and that's because how we feel loved is like a language, it's like a dialect, and it's very often based on personality, how we grew up. And so knowing and identifying what our specific love language is, what makes us feel loved, what makes our spouse feel loved, can provide a fabulously wonderful vehicle that will allow us to succeed to create the type of relationships that we all would love to have. And so what I would like to do, and you can't do it justice in a very brief time, and it's the type of thing that you'll need to think about over and over again, and it will continue to add and help you become more effective in creating the type of relationship you want. So let's go quickly through this concept of five love languages. And a little fun while we do it, when I go through the five love languages, what I'd like you to do is think about if you know your own. Most people have one or two that are higher than the five, right? All five are nice, but most of us have one or two that are primary, right? And see if you can guess what your spouse's primary love languages are. Okay? And then the person who wins gets a prize. But guess. See if you can guess. Okay, quickly. Let's go through those five love languages. The first, and there are no particular order. The first of the five love languages is something called words of affirmation. If my love language is words of affirmation, then I feel loved when my spouse expresses that love through giving me kind words, through saying nice things about me, through saying, expressing appreciation for who I am and what I bring to the table in the relationship. You know, the negative way of looking at it is the ultimate male ego. But there's some truth to that. It's about feeling loved. You feel loved when somebody takes the time to verbally express how you positively impact their life. And there are different dialects within each one of these languages. So sometimes words of affirmation, there's some nuances. Some people will feel loved when the spouse expresses appreciation for how you impact or they impact your life. Some people like it when you notice positive attributes in their work life, in other arenas. So I had a couple where it seemed that the husband's, one of his languages was words of affirmation. And the wife said, I've been trying, I've been giving it to him. And, you know, I said, well, what have you tried? She said, well, I tell him, you know, they don't have kids yet. They're a young couple. And he donates his time. He coaches football on Sunday. And she says, I tell him all the time how great it is that he does that and that he's such a great football coach and that he's so great with the kids and so on and so forth. And then I turned to him. I said, so you like that? He goes, yeah, then that's nice. I said, that's not what he wants. What he wanted was not the positive things she noticed that he does outside of their relationship, but how does he make her relationship, her life better? How does he make a positive impact on her? And when she expressed that, you could see the change in his face and how he felt. That's the first love language. Second love language is something called quality time. If your love language is quality time, you feel loved when your spouse expresses his or her love by giving you the gift of time. Gift of time is their undivided attention, making spending time with you a priority. It means that when you come home from work at night or after the kids are asleep and you sit down at the table, right, or you get into bed, your spouse is watching something on the TV, they turn off the spouse, they turn to you and they say, I feel like we haven't connected all day. I'd love to hear about your day. If your spouse's love language is quality time, they feel loved because you've given them their undivided attention and made that a priority. Quality time means meeting them for lunch. It means telling them, let's take a walk together. I want to hear about your day. It means listening. It means letting them know that their lives are important to you by prioritizing time and being interested in what they have to say. And that was mentioned before, listening, asking questions. But it's giving them their undivided attention and spending time with them. Running an errand could be quality time. Once you figure out these languages, what you're going to find, it becomes so much easier to make your spouse happy. Third love language. Third love language is something called receiving gifts. If your love language is receiving gifts, that means you feel love when your spouse expresses their love by giving you something, a symbol that notes that they were thinking of you. Now, receiving gifts, I think Rabbi Silver mentioned, doesn't mean a $4,000 piece of jewelry. I mean, it could. However, it could be buying your spouse's favorite piece of chocolate on the way home from work and saying, look, I was in a drugstore today. We don't find these very often. I thought of you, handing them a bag from like CVS and saying, I was thinking of you, and your spouse will feel loved. Writing a note on a napkin. Small trinkets that you know you like. Oh, you remember once you told me you collected, I don't know, and you buy that. It's thinking of them. And it's so interesting when we think about love as languages, as dialects. They're cultural. I always joke, you know, that my mother, I have a close relationship with my mother, but birthdays, it never was a big deal. She'll call me a month after my birthday and say, Aaron, did I forget your birthday again? And I said, yeah, I've been sitting here waiting by the phone. I don't care. Whereas my mother-in-law, nice pause, I could say anything now. Whereas my mother-in-law doesn't even forget my mother's birthday. So what that tells you is we were raised with a different way that expresses love. It's only taken us 17, 18 years to figure this out, so there's hope for all of us, right? So you see that it's very much based on our backgrounds, okay? So receiving gifts. Another love language, very quickly, is something called acts of service. Acts of service, if your love language is acts of service, that means you feel loved when your spouse expresses their love by doing things to make your life easier, by helping out in the house, by picking up your dry cleaning, by changing the baby's diaper, by mowing the lawn, by paying the bills, by seeing that you seem to be busy and overwhelmed and saying, is there something I can do that make your life easier? If your love language is acts of service, then you're going to feel loved if your spouse thinks of you and expresses that by taking a load off of your back, by helping you move through your day. So if your love language is acts of service and your spouse says to you, Cheryl, I know you're rushing out the door. Sweetie, I put your coffee and your bag right by the door so it's ready. That'll save you a minute. Have a great day. So that's an act of service because what you were doing is you were thinking about your spouse, anticipating their needs, and trying to make their life easier. Then they're going to feel loved. And it's so important why we get frustrated. Think about these ideas of the love languages. I know we've got one more. But think about somebody, husband or wife coming home from work, whichever spouse is at home. Somebody, you call up your spouse, you call up, your husband gets home first, he's dealing with the kids, he's giving this one a bath, this one, that, whatever it is. And so what happens? So the husband says, turn it around because I use, okay, the wife is at home in this, right? This actually happened. But the wife's at home saying, he calls from work, I'll be home in 20 minutes. She goes, great, I've got this one in the bath, I need help with this one. I've got to go to my meeting tonight at this and this time. Okay, I'll be there. He's driving home, and across the highway, he sees a flower stand. It's the spring, and he sees his wife's favorite flower. Pulls off the highway, goes across the road, he pays for the flowers, gets back, he walks in about 17 minutes later than he told his wife. He walks in, and she says, where were you? I've been waiting for you. And he says, I saw your favorite flower, and I couldn't pass it by, I wanted to bring it to you. Now, if her love language is receiving gifts, not always, but if her love language is receiving gifts, she might for that moment say, I can't believe you did that. That was so sweet. Oh my gosh. and she feels loved. If her love language is acts of service, she's... Yeah, I think we have more of those here, right? Yeah, you walk in the door, she says, look, I got you the flowers. Oh, great, fine. They fly across the room. And he feels frustrated because he feels like he's expressing love, but it didn't go over. He's not going to keep trying because he's got it the wrong way. The fifth love language. Fifth love language is something called physical touch. When we're talking about physical touch, we're not necessarily talking about sexual intimacy. If your love language is physical touch, you may feel loved when your spouse expresses their love through physical touch. It may be a rub on the shoulder, a pinch on the ear, right? Things like that. It's, you know, I call them drive-bys. If your love language is physical touch and they're paying bills and you walk by and you go over to your wife and you squeeze her shoulders, just wanted to say I love you, and you squeeze her shoulders and you walk by, she feels loved. People whose love language is physical touch. Rabbi Silverman expresses love through physical touch. Right? If you haven't seen him in any longer than anywhere from 12 minutes to an hour and a half, he's going to give you a bear hug. How are you? And grab you, because that's how he expresses love. Right? I'm thinking he usually, when you see his kids running out of his house like in terror, it's because he's feeling loving, right? He just went... So that's what we mean when we say physical touch. Physical touch, it's powerful. Some people don't like to be touched. Some people, when they're doing something, when they're writing, when they're working on something, and somebody comes over and touches them, squeezes them, gives them a kiss on their cheek, they're like, okay, what are you doing? Why are you bothering me? Why am I bothering you? What do you mean? That's not bothering. I'm trying to express my love. No, you're not. Don't tell me what I'm doing. You do that because your mother did it. No, that, your mother never did that. Okay, never mind. Okay, so we have those five love languages. And I know because of time, these love languages, they take some time to absorb. If you want to know how to guess, know what your love language is, if you don't know your spouse's and you want to know one of the ways that you might realize what yours is, ask yourself this question. When you were first married, or even now, when you're motivated to show love to your spouse, what's your first instinct to do? Right? How do you do it? How do you do it? Now, if you already know what it is, you're doing what you may be doing what he or she wants. But how do you express love in your first instinct? Do you run out and buy a gift? Do you say, oh, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to restock the refrigerator with her favorite this or that. What do you do? That might tell you what your love language is. If you want to know also maybe what yours or your spouse's, think about feeling in this. You know, the thing my spouse does or doesn't do that hurts me the most is, and think about the need behind the completion of that comment. So what I'd like to do is finish just with a story that will illustrate. This story happened in my marriage about 2 years ago, and it illustrates that as much I came across these five love languages and been using them with couples that I work with extensively, no matter what the issue is, I feel like I should always teach them. It's too powerful of a gift not to have them be able to have that. But what I find is that I came across this several years ago, and the power of our primary language is very instinctive. It's very built in. And so we have to think, and even after reading and teaching other couples, sometimes if we're not thinking about it, we won't choose the right language. We'll express our love in ways that we like. And so the example, the story I give is 2 years ago. It was the night before Rosh Hashanah. It was the night before Rosh Hashanah, and in my house that was a particularly crazy and hectic era of Rosh Hashanah. We had just started construction, so they had knocked down a few walls. The house was in shambles. I'm going to say the house is in shambles a few times just to make my wife uncomfortable, right? Two, she had just become president of one of the community organizations, our community, and she was trying to get a mailing out before Yontif, before Rosh Hashanah started, and that was going on. And Yontif that year fell out in the middle of the week, which means for all of us, we know what it's like when we're taking days off for Rosh Hashanah. You're going to take all those days off Yom Kippur. What happens, especially in my field, is it's... a huge segment of my clientele is not Jewish, and therefore I was condensing so many more client hours in longer days in order to provide services to meet with my clients and to get it in and make sure I met everybody's needs and gave people appointments, and it was just that pressure. So I have an office off in Marietta, and then I have an office where I see people at night in my home. So it was the night before Rosh Hashanah, the house is a mess, there's cooking going on, my wife and one of my daughters is trying to get out this mailing, and I'm downstairs seeing clients, and I'm thinking it's getting close to 10 o'clock at night as I'm wrapping up with my last client, and I'm thinking, okay, what I'm going to do, the last night of the year, I'm going to run in Beth Jacob. They have a late evening service at 9:45. The last night of the year before Rosh Hashanah, I'm going to try and pray with a minyan. I want to go to synagogue. I'm going to run out. I'd like to do that. So I figured that's important, and then I said, but I know, look, tomorrow morning, for those of you know, Shacharis morning services, the day of Rosh Hashanah, the day before Rosh Hashanah, are much earlier because there are extra prayers that we say. So my alarm was going to go off at 5:15, 5:30, whatever time it was. And so I said, but after that Meir service, after that evening service, I better run home and get to sleep because I want to have a very spiritually focused New Year, very spiritually focused Rosh Hashanah. And as I'm leaving Beth Jacob, I say, wait a minute. Part of having a spiritually focused Rosh Hashanah is also connecting with my spouse. I wasn't that sure with all that was going on if I remembered who she was, right? But it was so busy. I said, wait a minute, I'm not just going to go to sleep. So what can I do? What can I do tonight before I go to sleep that would be an expression of my love, that would be something meaningful to her? So what did I think? I'm thinking, okay, she's cooking, she's got this. You know what I do? When I walk in the house, instead of just going up and saying, oh, I'm so tired, I better go to sleep, I got to get up so early, what I'm going to do is clean out the fridge. I'm going to take everything that's been in there from that week, from Shabbos, I'm going to clean it out, I'm going to get it all, I'm going to get it in there, I'm going to put it away so that when the stuff comes out of the oven and she needs to put it away and she wants to go to sleep, the refrigerator will be totally clear and open. That would be a really big help. And then I said, you moron. Now, I didn't call her that. I said it to myself. And I said, that's what you would like. What would she like? So I call her up and I say, Devorah, I feel like it's Erev Hashanah. I feel like it's been so rushed. We haven't spent any time. Would you like to go to Brewster's? And she says to me, oh my gosh, that is so sweet. I pull up in front of the house. She's outside. She gets in the car. She goes, that was so nice. I pull up to Brewster's. I say, what do you want? She goes, I don't want any ice cream. These are how these things turn out. Then, of course, I get mad at her. I go, what do you mean you don't want any ice cream? I'm taking you out for ice cream. She goes, oh, I thought that because of everything that's going on, you must not have eaten dinner and you were hungry, and so you were going to grab some ice cream, and I thought it was so nice that you were asking me to go with you. I said, I can't eat ice cream. As I ran out to go to Meiriv, I tasted the meat you're making for Yontif. I'm fleishig. You better get some ice cream. I think I'm getting a little off point. However, the key is that expression. The next day when I was at work, I got out of a session, there was a message, and my wife said, Darren, that was so sweet that you thought of me and that you spent that time. And she really appreciated it. And what's powerful is because my love language obviously must be acts of service. Hers, one of them, is quality time. And let me show you how powerful that is, because let's say the situation was reversed. If I was sitting there doing paperwork, trying to get out, having things that I was cooking, doing this, and all this was going on, and she came in from somewhere, and I'm telling you this, this part is not an exaggeration, and she comes in and she says, hey, Aaron. She goes, I feel like we haven't been connecting or spending time. Would you like to go to Brewster's? I'd do this. Are you out of your freaking mind? Do you not see what I'm dealing with? I've got this here, I've got this, and you want to go to Brewster's? Would you pay attention? Maybe a little exaggeration. Well, you'll just have to guess. Because that would be an expression of love, yet it isn't my language. So that's a double-edged sword. So what I want you always to realize is, I use this analogy with clients. When your spouse asks you to scratch their back, and they say to you, no, not there, a little lower, you don't say to them, what are you being so critical for? I'm scratching your back. Be happy. No, you go, okay, where? Did I get it? Oh, yeah, there, let me try that. Right? No. And that's what you do. Because you want to get it where it itches. So think about the love language, meeting your spouse's need, in the same way. Accept guidance from your spouse about how to meet their needs. but also from the spouse. If your husband is scratching or your wife is scratching in the wrong place, be patient and forgiving and recognize they're scratching. So I wish all of us continued success, hatzlacha, in our commitment to building healthier, happy relationships. And thank JMI for the opportunity to share this evening with you. And I think now is questions.